Hello, you're listening to Rock and or Roll. I'm BJ, and joining me on today's episode is a frequent guest on the podcast, but it's probably been too long. Fistful of Dave. Hey, Dave.
Hello.
How's it going? Yeah, you're back.
Finally, it's going good.
Figured out a way to get you back on.
I thought he stopped liking me or something.
2 weeks here, we're going to talk about the Scorpions. Next week, we're going to talk about Scorpions in the 80s with Joe Roiland, but for this week, we're going to cover the Scorpions in the 70s, and an obvious choice for a co-host for this episode was you, so thanks for doing it.
Anytime.
You probably got into the Scorpions long before me. I mean, they were definitely one of the first bands that I got into, but it would have been like mid-80s, like Love at First Sting was already out. I still remember trying to track down all the tapes, like all the old albums. My uncle, frequently mentioned on the podcast, uncle, this is one of the bands he wasn't into. He didn't have the Scorpions, so me and my friend Dan probably got into them just from the fucking radio, Laser 103 or MTV. But Dan's dad would drive us around Milwaukee to all the record stores on the weekends, and so I remember, you know, there was a point where I was just trying to find Lonesome Crow, you know, because I just had a list. I knew what Scorpions albums there were, trying to find them. And
the first one I got into was Love Drive, because they played Love Drive on the radio. I heard Love Drive on the radio, went and bought it, and it must have been shortly before Blackout came out, because I got that second. But this early stuff wasn't, you didn't see it a lot. You saw a lot of that best of, and I never was, I don't know why, I always wanted to buy full albums. So I think I was of the mindset that my favorite song was never the hit on records. So I was like, I'm going to miss a song I really like if I buy the best of. So I was trying to find that stuff, and you really couldn't find it for a while. And then like 82, when I started high school, I met this guy, and, you know, we would go record shopping together, and then we would go and, you know, we just listened to what we bought or whatever in his basement. And him and his brother had all the old Scorpion stuff, so that's when I heard all of that stuff. Which was interesting, because it was this kind of the love-hate thing between, like, wow, the songs that Klaus sings, I really like, and the songs that Uli sings are good, except for he's singing them.
Exactly, yeah.
So then slowly would find them that way. That was kind of my thing. But I didn't get in until, you know, like 70, 79, so.
And when I was trying to find them, you had to find them used. The early ones, you couldn't just walk into any store and buy In Trance, from my memory. So I was just trying to find them. I don't even know how or what was available at the time. I remember, like, I still remember getting my mom, you know, my mom would take me to, we would go to Kmart and be there for like a fucking hour. And I would always lose her and be walking around the store for 20 minutes trying to find her. And I remember, and I would always just be looking at the cassettes. And I still remember, like, cajoling her into getting me Love at First Sting. Like, with the censored, my tape had the censored album cover with just the band photo.
Oh, right.
On it.
And, yeah, I was kind of similar. We'd go to Target.
Yeah.
And it used to be when I was, you know, you're a little kid, it's like, can I go to the toy section? But then it was after I started buying records a lot, like, probably around 10 years old. And it's like, I was always trying to find Black Sabbath at that time, but it was like, and go over to the cassettes and find whatever, you know, I was looking for. That was before my Scorpions time. My thing with the Scorpions by that time is, I don't know if I didn't know that used record stores existed or not until there's a used record store in Milwaukee that was called Recordhead. And I don't know when I finally ran into it. It must have been about 84. I just didn't know that was something that happened, that you could buy used records. Yeah. And then once that happened, it was a lot easier to find some of that older stuff that just kind of was gone. But
yeah, Dan's dad took us to Recordhead all the time. I still remember buying the first two Maiden albums on cassette at Recordhead. Like, you always have these memories. Like,
right, yeah. Where
you know, when I look through my collection, I can't remember when and where I got most of it, but for some reason there's still certain ones where you remember the exact moment when you got it. So
yeah, and it's weird why it sticks with you. Yeah. I mean, I bought Stiff Little Fingers and Flammable Material in Amsterdam.
Right. So you would remember that.
On CD. I had it already on record, but yeah. I remember buying that in Amsterdam on CD. I have no idea why, but, you know.
Well, you were in Amsterdam, that would be.
Right, right.
So Rudolf Schenker first formed a band called The Scorpions in 1965, supposedly. And I think at that time, Klaus Meine, or is it Klaus, is it Meine? Like, I know I always called him Mine when I was a kid.
That's,
like, when
that's
I didn't
what
know
I always
better.
Called him.
Klaus Meine, Klaus Meine, or whatever. He was in a band called Mushrooms.
Yes.
And it was in 1970 that Klaus and Rudolph's brother, Michael, were in a band together called Copernicus. We have to thank Martin Popoff for a lot of these details. He's got a great book about the Scorpions. Rudolph stole them, I guess, for a new version of the Scorpions. So Klaus and Michael Schenker were in a band together before they were in the Scorpions, which is pretty interesting.
Right.
And so at that time, when Klaus and Rudolph come together, they're both 22 and Michael was 15. And it took 2 years for them to make their first record. And so the band that made Lonesome Crow, the first Scorpions album, was Rudolph and Michael Schenker and Klaus and Lothar Heimberg on bass and Wolfgang Dzionny on drums. And that record was produced by Connie Plank, who was really prominent in the krautrock scene that I did that weird episode about way back when with Jason. Anyways, Connie Plank, he was an early, like, influential proponent of electronic music and everything. I guess probably the whole rock scene in Germany at the time was krautrock. Like, that was pretty much everything when the Scorpions were starting out, it seems like, or that was the biggest thing.
I think that's one of the things they talk about in the book a lot, too, is that they were different for everybody else was doing, you know, if not electronic, experimental. I mean, there's, there's all those krautrock can and all of that stuff that was going on at that time. And this record's even on, I guess you would call it a krautrock label at the time, Brain.
Yeah, and a krautrock producer. Like, but there's nothing krautrock about it. And yet you will see the Scorpions lumped in with krautrock, which makes me think that that's just like all there was in Germany. And so they were kind of like a real oddball band, I think, in Germany, like in the early 70s.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's definitely, there's like some space rock. I mean, to me, this record sounds like, Lonesome Crow sounds like, if you took some Black Sabbath and Hawkwind and smashed it together, you would get Lonesome Crow. And I think
a lot of it has like a real 60s hippie vibe kind of to it, too.
Well, and if you go through the lyrics, that kind of sticks with them through the 70s.
Yeah.
and it's part of a Uwe thing, but there's a hippie kind of, like, I was looking at the lyrics and they're very kind of mystical.
Yeah.
Until Herman starts writing lyrics.
It feels a little bit proggy, which was another big thing in Germany, I think, was Prague, too.
Yeah, so, I think that's kind of the Hawkwind thing I got out of.
Yeah. I don't really like Lonesome Crow much at all. It's interesting to hear 17-year-old Michael Schenker. He does a lot of lead work. Like, he's pretty prominent on the album.
He's really prominent. And I think if you played it somebody that didn't know, I don't know they would get the Scorpions out of it. Because Klaus might give it away in places, but he really doesn't sound like he does, even going to Fly to the Rainbow. He sounds different. And Schenker sounds like Tony Iommi soloing. Like, it's really frenetic and not, you know, not the melodic thing everyone's used to with what he's playing. And even that he would go to on UFO's Phenomenon, you know, it's a lot more, you know, the style when you say Michael Schenker and I get goosebumps because I hear them playing, it's not like that at all. And there's pieces that you can kind of go, yeah, I can hear where that's coming from, but it's definitely someone trying to figure out, you know, what they're trying to do. And Michael always talks about, finding his own path and doing his own kind of music. And I think that, you know, I don't think he was there yet. I don't think that was till UFO where he was playing how he wanted to play, that he was more, I don't know, copying is the right word, but, emulating, I guess is a better word, than doing his own thing at the time.
So I guess the most prominent thing about Lonesome Crow is just that you get to hear a 17-year-old Michael Schenker do a lot of lead work, and so that's probably the most significant thing about it, really. Otherwise, I don't really care for it, personally. But it was while touring for Lonesome Crow that the Scorpions opened for another band called UFO. And apparently Bernie Marsden, UFO's guitar player, had an issue with his passport, and Michael ended up filling in for him. I don't know if it was just one show or two or what it was, but
there's a couple shows, and the story with that is all over the place.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's that Bernie Marsden just didn't show up, but, you know, whatever it is, that you know, Michael had to fill in those couple shows or whatever.
Yeah, and I guess the seed was planted at that point, even though it would be a few years before he would, or a couple years, I guess. Well, I don't know. When did he? Well, Phenomenon's what, 74? So,
yeah.
So how soon was it? Was it pretty soon?
So he left. So he filled in those shows. They went back to England, and then I think got a hold of him to say, "Did you want to join the band?" But it was fairly quickly. I think it was like right after that tour. And then Michael Schenker had always said, "You know, if an English band comes, well, this is what he says at least. When if an English band comes and asks me to play, I'm going to go and join." So it almost seems like it didn't matter what English band it was, as long as it was that's where the rock and roll that he was into was coming from, that he would join that band. And, you know, listening to the, you know, the first, whatever, two in the live record for those UFO records, I'm not quite sure. I mean, I don't really care for Lonesome Crow, but I like those UFO records less than I like Lonesome Crow.
Yeah, it seems like Michael Schenker completely transformed that band. That's what, how it seems.
Yeah, I mean, they were very primitive. I mean, they were more primitive. It was like sub-Blue Cheer primitive kind of thing, and then all of a sudden they were a lot... And not as much on Phenomenon, but shortly after, that stuff got fairly, you know, complex about the interplay between guitars and boat, you know, and how all that stuff works, and the melodies and the counter melodies that he brought to him came right after that. But yeah, he definitely transformed them.
So Michael leaves Scorpions, joins UFO, and they replace him with a 19-year-old German hippie named Uli John Roth.
Yeah, I don't know how to say it. I'll probably say it both ways.
Yeah, right, exactly. And he was in a band called Dawn Road, and so he brought the rhythm section of that band, Francis Buchholz and Jürgen Rosenthal, with him. And actually, my takeaway from, it seems like Martin Popoff interviewed Francis Buchholz for his book, and the way Francis describes it, it seems more like Rudolph and Klaus joined Dawn Road, you know, but then they just used the Scorpions name because it had more notoriety and...
Yeah, they had been playing already or whatever. I've seen that in a few places, so...
Yeah, it seems like the Scorpions basically broke up when Michael left, and then they kind of reconstituted with Dawn Road as this new version of the band. And so then the record they make in November... It comes out in November 74, Flight of the Rainbow, was produced by Frank Bornemann, who was like the founding member of pretty legendary German progressive rock band Eloy.
Right,
so they go from krautrock producer to prog producer, which, like, I guess that was the whole German rock scene at the time, basically. And the first song on Flight of the Rainbow, Speedy's Coming, I mean, it's nothing. There's no resemblance to Lonesome Crow, and it's basically what would become the Scorpion sound.
Yeah,
like, it's all there practically in this song.
That's the template.
Yeah.
Like, it's like, I think you could take Speedy's Coming... Like, if they had not released it and they're like, hey, we got this song Speedy's Coming, and you put it on any of the 80s records and just, you know,
right.
You update
yeah.
it,
yeah.
you wouldn't know the difference because it's really similar. I mean, obviously differences with, the big difference is Uli in the band and how that interplays with everybody else. But they pretty much, I mean, for me, it's like, yeah, this is kind of the template. And obviously this is, you know, a little... Fly the Rainbow, say Undercooked, or just, you know, kind of, this is their second record and they're still kind of feeling where they're going, but it's definitely the sound that you hear later.
Yeah, strangely, the rest of Flight of the Rainbow is more similar to Lonesome Crow than it is to Speedy's Coming, probably, but they really nailed it with that one song, and it's such a stark transition from Lonesome Crow to Speedy's Coming. There's really barely any similarity.
Yeah, I think it's more cohesive record. Like, I tried listening. Lonesome Crow is one of those records I know a few people that like, and every once in a while, it's like, oh, whoever likes this, like, I can't figure out why they like it, and I'm like, maybe I'm missing something, and I go back. And for this, I went back, obviously, and listened to it, and I was like, there's just, it's all over the place. This record, at least, even if it sounds more similar to Lonesome Crow, is definitely more focused and has an idea of where the heck it's going than... You know, there's just stylistic changes, I think, on Lonesome Crow that were just like, what's happening? It's probably one of those things. These are all the songs we have. We're going to record them. And there was no thought besides that into what they were doing. So
at this point, Dieter Dierks or Dierks enters the picture. It's hilarious. There's so many names that, you know, when I was 12 years old, I read a Dieter Dierks.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I refuse to say Fraley. I will say Freely, Ace Freely, until I die, because I can't. can't, how do I change that? You know, when my whole life it was Ace Frehley and now I'm supposed to say Frehley, you know, fuck that. So
I've changed, I can do the Frehley and I do it, but I know what you're saying. It's like
Frehley sounds so much cooler.
But it's like Uli and Yuli. I hear people say that all the time. I'm like, I have no idea what, I'll just call him Ulrich then. Like,
or Ulrich.
Yeah, exactly.
So Dieter Dierks, that's probably correct. Dierks. My whole childhood, I thought Dieter Dierks. But, you know, he was he's another major player in the krautrock scene. I think a lot of krautrock was recorded at his studio. But, you know, I was looking at this and I was like, he plays the exact same role with the Scorpions that Bob Ezrin played with Alice Cooper. Like, those first two Alice albums weren't very good, and then Bob Ezrin enters the picture, and it's just magic. Like, it's just fucking locked down, and they know exactly what they're doing, you know?
Yeah.
And so he's, like, and the production, you know, some of his production, it's weird how the albums are differently. Even though it's Dieter Dierks, they're differently produced. But
Well, and you can kind of see the gradual change, but it's definitely between Taken by Force and Love Drive, it's like,
yeah.
What? Wow. Like, okay. And we can get more into that later. But
so Dieter and his wife, Karina, they went to a gig at a local sports hall in Essen. That's what it says in Martin's book. And they just happened to see the Scorpions playing at this hall. And they were impressed. And then eventually Dieter's hired by RCA to produce them. And then he would eventually sign them to his company. Was he their manager then? When he signed them to his company, I guess. I'm not sure exactly what that means.
I don't know how clear that was.
His company.
Yeah, there was a bunch of kind of, you know, it's kind of like the drama that it seems like the Scorpions always had recording drama going through Martin's book.
Yeah.
It's like every time it was like they weren't happy about something or something weird happened or the room was too small or whatever it was, or they flew all their gear to one studio and then had to truck it to another studio or whatever's going on. But I want to say I don't recall them that he didn't manage them right away, but that But I don't know, there was kind of a, he produced them then managed them, and I don't know what the length of time between it was, but it didn't seem real long.
It seems like he saw what was different about them and encouraged them to explore that, like focus on the heavy hard rock aspects.
Yeah, focus on that, and I think the other thing is that they were determined to be big. Like, they talk about it from the beginning, they wanted to be big in England, they wanted to go to America and all that kind of stuff. So they definitely had, you know, work ethic or drive that, you know, somebody that in the business would be like, oh, these guys have it, they're good, and put some money behind them and, you know, see what we can do.
Right. But, you know, the kind of music they were making, like, there was no reason to expect that it was going to become popular at the time.
No,
I don't think.
Well, how many bands would get as many years as the Scorpions got?
Yeah.
Now, like they would have never got to Fly to the Rainbow.
Right.
They're like, nope, done with you guys.
Yeah.
Like, nah, you can't do anything. And you know, they got almost, you know, what is it, 6 years of doing records to, you know, finally get it where they, you know, and it was like overnight between, not that they were an overnight success, but between, you know, what they were and when they got popular, all of a sudden they're popular. It's like, it's odd. So
In Trance comes out in September of 75, and you know, it's hard to quantify exactly how much credit Dieter Dierks deserves, but you know, holy shit, the band's sound is like very defined and focused, it seems like. And I mean, it's really impressive, especially considering that it's 1975. This is before Sad Wings of Destiny, which is why I think Scorpions deserve a lot of credit when it comes to influencing what would eventually become what's identifiable as heavy metal in the 80s. I think they were a massive influence on a lot of people. And since this predates Sad Wings of Destiny even, you know, they definitely deserve a lot of credit for being very early proponents of a certain kind of sound, you know, with the lead guitar work and the vocal style. You know, this is going to be very, very influential, as far as I can tell.
Well, there's a book by Greg Prado, called German Heavy Metal Machine, I believe is what it's called. And he interviews, you know, there's like guys from Anvil, and it actually is a lot of thrash guys, but they were talking on how much early Scorpions was, you know, was as important as Judas Priest and all that to what they were doing, you know, in the early 80s. So
for sure. And I've always thought of, I mean, like, I'm like, there weren't any other bands. There were so few bands doing this kind of music until all of a sudden it exploded. And like when I talked to Marty Friedman and he was doing that band Deuce in the late 70s, and I asked him, I'm like, because they were before or at the same time as the new wave of British heavy metal, so they weren't influenced by that. They were just doing the same kind of music at the same time as those other bands, but independent of them. And I remember he just rattled off Priest, Scorpions, Riot, Y&T, and that's like all there was. You know, that's right. What they were into. Because those were the only bands. Those were the bands that influenced them, because that's pretty much the only bands that were making this certain like niche kind of music at the time.
Yeah, you know, I almost think it's like some weird... They always, it's weird. Scorpions often cite, it seems like Black Sabbath early on at least, and Led Zeppelin. And I can almost see like, you know, this weird combination of, you know, Uli's Hendrix kind of thing mixed with Led Zeppelin, but then like some weird German take on it. I don't know, because it's, you know, it's obviously different. And I'll hear Zeppelin every once in a while in what they're doing. But yeah, they're definitely, unique as far as their sound was, and I think a lot of the stuff, I mean, they had some, and there's not a lot of harmony guitar lead stuff going on, but it's there in places that they're doing it. So there's a lot of stuff that people, you know, make attribute to other bands that they were doing before. So
right, and so this is the point where they get their logo, which the record label supplied the logo, which was just the font from the film Rollerball. It's just the exact font.
Yes.
And now they're kind of transformed with this album into more of like kind of this dark, aggressive, scary band with a censored album cover. It all starts on In Trance.
Yeah.
So, and then they will continue this, the theme of kind of, you know, you got to think of in context of 1975 when I say dark, scary, you know, everyone's going to look back at it and say, but at the time, that's what it was.
Yeah, I mean, they had the whole... I mean, like I said, there's the whole mystical element to the lyrics that Uli brings, I think. And, I mean, there's Sabbath, but and you have all the other stuff, Zeppelin and Mountain and whatever that was slightly before. But there's nothing like this, so it's definitely a new take on heavier rock. So
yeah, there's these certain elements that become very identifiable as heavy metal, and this is one of the earliest examples where you hear these certain little differences... in like the riffs and the guitar tone and the lead work and the vocals and all that kind of stuff. And, yeah, and then like the lyrical themes and just like the controversy and the, you know. So
yeah, I find it amazing that the cover controversy.
Yeah.
I mean, even with the Flight of the Rainbow, that the band wasn't happy with it because of
You know, I was looking at my record this morning, and I had never noticed that the names of the band members on the back are on the ass of the guy. Like, they just put an oval right on his ass and put the names of the guys in the band.
Right. I mean, so they go from that, you know, to the In Trance cover. And I really like the In Trance cover. I think it's a good picture and whatever. But it is one of those things, like, it doesn't look risque now, but, you know, they're kind of a woman getting off on a guitar. You know, I guess for 1975 is maybe problematic, but
well, and you mentioned Uli's voice. I still remember finding this tape as a kid at I think it was at Radio Doctors in Milwaukee. Like I said, my friend Dan's dad drove us there, and when we left the store, he popped this tape in, and Dark Lady starts, and we're all like, "What the fuck?" Because you know, that would have been the first time I heard Uli sing. And so we were all very confused.
The interesting things is, you know, Uli talks in the book a lot about, you know, I had songs, but I didn't, you know, I would kind of determine if Klaus could sing them, or, you know, if it's something, you know, it seemed like he determined if he thought Klaus could sing it. And this is a song where he thought Klaus should sing the whole song. And Dieter Dirk said, no, you should sing the verse parts. But I listen to this thing and go, dude, Klaus just is saying the whole thing, and Dark Lady would be...
It'd be much better.
immensely improved.
Yeah, yeah. So the next album, Virgin Killer, I think they nail it. I think the production on Virgin Killer is perfect. Like, really tightened up from Entrance to my ears. And, yeah, I'm sure you're laughing because of the album cover. Well, the album cover is horrific, and the band blames the record company. And I love in Martin's book, it says there's all different ages that were put out for the girl, but then Martin seems to confirm that she was 10.
Right.
But he says her mother and her aunt were present at the photo shoot, as was the photographer's wife. So they're trying to minimize
And I had the vinyl of the, you know, the American cover, which is with the guys on the cover. Yeah, and then I came across a box set because I wanted the CDs, and there is the label in France called Axe Killer. And they put out this box set, and it's Fly the Rainbow, Entrance, and Virgin Killer. And so I get it, and to my horror, I open it, and that original cover's in there. I'm like, oh, it's in my house. This is terrible.
But do you know about the controversy on Wikipedia? Like, they were flagged for child pornography when they put the album cover on Wikipedia, and there was a legal battle, I think. And they still managed to keep it on Wikipedia, but I think they had a lot of issues. It was a controversy of some sort.
I'm kind of horrified that it's in my house, and I'm not quite sure what to do with it. Because on like the one hand, like, no, I just want to keep the set together, because the record collector dork in me is like, you know, leave it that way. On the other hand, I'm like, I don't want that in my house, man.
Yeah.
And luckily it's in a box set, so, you know, and I do everything digitally, but yeah, that's an awful cover.
Last year I was at this flea market place in Monona, Wisconsin, and they have some records there that it's like a consignment type dealer place. And I was just looking through the records, and there was a record with a piece of paper, well, just a like 8.5 by 11 piece of paper stuck in the sleeve, but I could see what it was. I pull out the paper, and it was this cover. It was like, I think it was $40. And I was like, I don't think this would be cool to have, even though it's the original cover. Like,
no, I was,
I don't like think I want this, even though it's like, you know, some rare original Scorpions thing. So.
Yeah, well, that's like, even, like I said, like, I was kind of freaked out when I got it. I'm like, I don't really, what do? Do I just send it back or what? Because I was like, yeah.
But then I went back there later to that store to look at it again. It was gone. So somebody did buy it.
Yeah.
They could probably sell it for more than 40 on eBay, so.
Yeah, I think that's one of those things people always say, like, well, now we find it, you know, whatever, offensive. But when I was a kid, I was like, why is there a little girl on that?
Yeah,
like,
it's pretty insane.
I could understand if it was a woman naked on there.
Well, like, and then the album title.
Yeah, what? Exactly.
It pretty much.
And they're like, and the band's like, oh, I don't know, it seemed like a good idea. Or
yeah.
Really? It did?
It's
okay.
Nuts. It's pretty fucking nuts.
Since at this photo shoot you felt you need to have the kid's family there and the photographer's mother, you know, wife there. So, yeah, it was okay. They were all there. I probably should have told you. Maybe you shouldn't have used it.
I also love the story in Martin's book that Francis Buchholz tells, I think, that the drummer Rudy Lenners had to go to the hospital with a nervous breakdown after Dieter made him play the same part over and over. Yeah. And then he ends up out of the band pretty soon, I think, after this record, too. So
yeah, I think it was shortly. I don't know if he even came back from that. I don't know if he did. Yeah. But I think he went to wherever he went, and I think that they replaced him. Like, the record was, it was after the record, I think, and for the tour, I think, is they replaced him.
Did Herman do this tour?
I think.
Yeah. So the album comes out in October 76. So this is between Sad Wings of Destiny and Sin After Sin. So you get, it goes Entrance, Sad Wings, Virgin Killer, Sin After Sin. And that's when this whole sound is like being created, right. You know? Right. Yeah. I think the production on Virgin Killer, like I said, is perfect. It's really awesome. It's really great. So,
yeah, I think this album's a little back heavy with Uli sung songs.
Yeah, not every song is great, but the good songs are really fucking good. So
yeah,
but yeah, I don't really like any of the songs Uli sings. I could see the potential in Dark Lady, but the other ones, I don't know if I even see the potential in them.
Yeah, well, Hellcat.
Oh yeah, that's one of the worst. Yeah.
But it's always like, I listen to him, and I find myself listening to him now, and I kind of, you know, scrub through him to get to the solos, because Uli Roth soloing is just always amazing. Like, every song, even if it's the smallest part, it's just so perfect for whatever the song is that I'll go through and listen to that. I even listen to some of his solo albums because the guitar playing is just so ridiculously amazing. And I think this is another one to say on Uli is everybody talks about Yngwie Malmsteen, you know, oh, he ripped off Ritchie Blackmore. And he did, but he really ripped off Uli. Like, if you listen to it and then listen to what Malmsteen plays, it's like, that's where he got it from. And he and Malmsteen for the longest time said, I've never listened to the Scorpions with Uli Roth. I've never listened to him. And then finally, apparently, he admitted it that was the big influence. So,
why would he deny it? Probably that. I guess that
hide and seek
is testament to how much he ripped him off. Is that he didn't want to admit it?
I think it's testament to that, but I think it's one of those that, you know, like, nobody knows. If nobody's noticing, then I see more original, and you know, you just play it that way. But.
Right. So. This is the point where Herman Rarebell enters the story. Herman's a German. Herman right away kind of inserts himself. I don't know how much of it is him, but he becomes like prominent in the songwriting process, which I kind of have a theory that's part of the discontent with Uli was Herman coming in and, you know, starting to playing a role in the songwriting and how that came about and who... if it was Dieter or who was, you know, giving Herman this role, you know, how he, you know, rose to that level of writing lyrics to a lot of the songs, or not a lot. I was under the impression he had written more of the lyrics than he actually did when I started looking at the writing credits. But
right. That's because you listen to Herman talk.
Right, when he talks about
everything.
Yeah.
But I think it's that. I think it's also part of Uli pulling away in this album. From reading about Herman, I can imagine being in a band with him and being like, holy shit, this guy driving me fucking crazy.
Yeah.
Like, just such a larger than life, and I did everything, and not, you know, and like, he's very, you know, into what he's doing, but I think he would be somebody that's hard to deal with. And I think Uli's laid back kind of hippie thing, and this, hey, I want to be huge, came in, and the band was already heading that way. He's like, oh, now there's another one, and he's, you know, we have love songs, but it was never this crude.
Yeah.
You know, he was really offended by He's a Woman, She's a Man. He's like, what is that? That's terrible. You know, I think he found it, you know, just how, not necessarily the subject matter, but just how, you know, raw it was, or how just uncouth, I guess. Yeah, crude, uncouth, or whatever that it was. And you know, and because they had to coerce him from that book, it said there's a few times that they had to coerce Uli into playing solos on some of the songs. And
yeah, and Taken by Force, which comes out in December 77, this one I never found as a kid. I never heard this until I remember it was when I lived on the east side of Milwaukee in like 98 that I first got this record, I think. So
yeah, I had found this on import in probably 84, but it's the original. It's that original cover with the crosses on and the kids.
Cemetery, right?
Yeah. And then I saw, when there's like kids playing guns in the cemetery.
Right.
And the U.S. label was like, no, dude, Vietnam, bad, you know, whatever. Kind of a bad thing. And then it's funny because I had seen Taken by Force and it's like, I was like, is this a different album? And I'm like, I don't think it's a different, and I, you know, obviously looked at it, but there's always the Scorpions. Like, how many records do they have alternate covers for that you would see? I mean, it's,
yeah,
there's four, right?
Right. Yeah. They had four censored albums in a row. No, five. Four in a row. And then Blackout, they managed not to be censored. And then Love at First Sting, they're censored again.
Right. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, you look at them, and I get, you know, some of them why people are, you know, you look at the Love Drive cover, but it never bothered me. I always thought it was funny. I didn't even thought it was sexual when I was a kid. Like, oh, there's a boob is out or whatever. I was just like, that's kind of funny. She's laughing. It's weird. Why are they in this thing? You know, it was just really odd, but I'm really into the Hypnosis covers, so maybe that's part of it. But I never thought it's like, being weirdly sexual. It wasn't like one of those things like, yeah, let's go pull out that Scorpions record because there's a boob on it or anything. It was just like, that's weird.
Yeah, so Take It by Force, I think I knew the title, but I never found it you know, when I was collecting all the Scorpions album, like I was talking about, I never got this one, and that's too bad, because I would have definitely liked it when I was a kid. It's a mostly heavy metal record, really.
It's mostly a metal record, and not that there's a lot of Roth compositions on here, but he doesn't sing on this record.
Right. I didn't think about that, but that's true. He doesn't sing. Probably another foreshadowing.
That's a big thing with it. I listen to it and I'm like, you know, there's songs I love on this. And as sitting down listening to it, it's not as jarring because it just claws through the whole thing. And I don't have to be like, it's kind of like a movie. I think sometimes when you're listening to a record and something like that happens, like Uli comes on and I'm just taken out of the whole thing. Like, oh yeah, Uli's singing and I'm not really listening anymore. Yeah. And you don't get that on this.
So I think how it worked was, while they were making the record, I think they knew Uli was going to leave, but they convinced him to do the tour, and then they said, you know, we'll make a live record, and that will be, like, you know, the end of an era. So I think the whole, like, tour and making the Tokyo tapes, it was all, they knew Uli was leaving the band, so they were just kind of putting a button on it or whatever. And
And they had to talk him into doing Japan, but I don't think it was a big, like, hey, we're huge in Japan, you should go and do this, And Uli even says there's some of the, you know, the one show that didn't get recorded for whatever reason was like the best. He's like, it's some of the best shows that they had ever played.
Yeah, Tokyo Tapes is a great live record. I've never been a big fan of live records. Like, I would almost always put a studio record on before I would listen to a live record. But Tokyo Tapes is a really cool live album.
Yeah, I'm kind of with you on live albums. There's anomalies. And, you know, I like the ones everybody likes. I think once the 80s hit, live records, you know, because I think a lot of the what happened in the studio was more what the band sounded like, so you didn't really need, you know, like Worldwide Live just sounds like sped up versions of the studio songs. Like, there's not, you know, it's not like, oh, that's so much heavier or whatever it is. It's, you know, it's just kind of what it was, whatever, to me. I think my main exception, like my favorite Saxon album is The Eagle Has Landed, but it has more to do with, I think, the performances of the songs over versus the studio versions that are a little more pedestrian, but I'd agree with you. I'd rather listen to a studio record.
So Uli leaves, and it's according in Martin's book, it says that they auditioned 140 guitarists. I think that's from Martin's book. And they end up picking Matthias Jabs, summer 1978. They made a great choice there. Out of those 140 guitarists, I think. He had been in a few bands, Lady, Fargo, and Deadlock. I don't think he had ever been in a band that had a record or anything. But so Matthias is put in this precarious position where, you know, he wins these fucking auditions out of 140 guys. And then as soon as he gets the job, Michael Schenker, you know, is coming, is around. And that must have been just torture for him. So they're making the record, and Michael's there playing on the record too. And it's Rudolph's brother, and it's Michael Schenker. So, you know, even though Matthias gets the job, they end up saying, sorry, but we're going to go with Michael.
Well, and then they play kind of, they have him come and play. Michael comes in and play. He finishes up the record. They go on tour. Michael doesn't show up. They call him. He shows up. Yeah. Michael shows back up.
Yeah. It must have been torture for him.
Like, I ain't gonna understand if you're Matthias, like, going, all right, you get to the end of the rope, but it's like, I'm gonna hang on to this because the Scorpions are, you know, it's better than anything that I got going. So.
Well, and you could probably see that Michael Schenker, oh yeah, this guy's not gonna make it. You know, this ain't gonna last. You know. It might have been pretty obvious. I like that in Martin's book that he makes it clear that, I think Matthias says it, that they never played a show with all three guitar players. That never happened.
Right.
Which is something that I'd always wondered, I think, is how did that work? Because there was a point, I think there was a point where they were both kind of in the band.
Right.
And yeah, we talked about the cover, the great Hypnosis cover, and it says in Martin's book that was Elton John's limousine that they were in.
Oh yeah, that's right.
And yeah, I think that's a great album cover. You know, it's a classic Hypnosis cover, you know.
Right.
So
totally.
I think, to my ears, the production on Love Drive isn't very good. It's so different.
It's so different, and I think it's a little, well, especially when you're comparing it to what came before. Like, there's a lot of volume. not meaning loudest, but, you know, there's a kind of a girth to everything that they had done before. And this is definitely a lot more crisp, a lot more just mid-range. And then I think my biggest issue with the production on this is, and they do this from, not, you know, from here out, at least with the Dieter Dirk stuff, is the lead guitar is just buried.
Like, yeah, and the vocals are kind of buried a lot, too.
That's, you know, because it's, I remember finding out, like, oh, Michael Schenker played on it or whatever, and being like, he does? I'm like, it doesn't sound like him. And then when you listen real close, like, oh, yeah, yeah, there's the his sound, and I can, how he plays, because you can pick that out, but it's so buried that it's not really prominent, whereas the lead guitar when Uli was in the band is loud. I mean, it, when that solo comes in, you know he's playing, and it's kind of the opposite of that. It's like he wanted to downplay that and, you know, more song, or, you know, focus on the song kind of thing instead of the guitar solo.
Maybe it's more the mix that's the problem than the production per se, but I think it was experimental. Like, they were trying to figure it out, and so it's kind of a transitional record moving yeah. forward.
I think there's a lot of that whole thing. Like, you go to the 70s, and yeah, again, I say that you have that volume or the full or the earthy kind of bass. You know, there's a lot of it's bass heavy kind of thing to the 80s, where everything is a lot more high end and mid range. And a lot of the metal production you got, I mean, you know, talks in that book about them going into the Dieter Dirks being into the way that Mutt Lange produces. And this is around the time of what, 79 is Highway to Hell, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, Mutt Lange's already out there. So, you know, had Dieter Dirks heard this stuff and already been kind of like, oh, that's the future. I want to go that way. I know they talk about it more on Love It for Sting in that book about, you know, production or whatever the heck, but I think it starts here that he's definitely being influenced by some other way of recording than he had been doing.
Yeah, I get the impression from a lot of late 70s albums that where you get the impression that they saw the 80s coming and everybody was trying to, they knew there was going to be a change or a shift, and people are mm-hmm. trying to anticipate it and, you know, figure out where they're going to go in the 80s.
Right, well, you think 79 and think about the amount of new wave and power pop albums that are coming out at this time. And those are super yeah. glossy, shiny, high-endy. You know, there's not a lot of boom on the bottom end to them. And I don't know how much that affected it, but that's, you know, definitely happening at this time. And even since, like, maybe, what, 77, that you've seen some of this stuff coming.
So I would say, personally, Love Drive is my least favorite of the Dieter Dirks albums for my personal taste or opinion, I guess.
Well, I mean, is Savage Amusement him? I'll go with Savage.
Oh, did he produce that?
I think Savage Amusement, right. Keith Olsen did Crazy World. That's after that, right? With,
yeah.
With, but I would agree. I mean, out of the ones, you know, I'm in all the way up to Love It for Sting, including Love It for Sting. And I would agree that, you know, this is probably the, even the ones he's produced before, probably the, maybe, I don't know, least like. I mean, it's, I guess there's more average songs on this one, that it's a lot more like Taken by Force that you can listen in front to back. But I don't think there's as many standouts as there are to come on the next few records.
Right.
What does that have to do with Michael Schenker being in and out of the band with the songwriting? I mean, I know he, you know, that's one of the big contentions with Michael, is he's not credited on any of the stuff, but he wrote Coast to Coast. Rudolph didn't write Coast to Coast. Like, that's,
Coast
I think
to
that's
Coast is pretty awesome.
Right. No, it's a, you're right. It's great, but I think that's a Michael song. And then you know how much he had to do, but he's, and that's the thing. All the songs, all my favorite songs in this: "Loving You Sunday Morning," "Another Piece of Meat," "Coast to Coast," "Love Drive," and "Holiday." Those are the ones with Michael Schenker on, and those are all my favorite songs on this record. So
yeah, those are the, and yeah. Now that I think about it, "Coast to Coast" completely sounds like Michael Schenker wrote it. It really does.
But I mean, you listen to it, you listen to it, because there's, you know, there's the guitar part, and then, but the solo, like, oh yeah, that's total, like, the little thing he does, it, there's a little thing, kind of this intense little picking thing he does at the end, and I'm like, oh, that's totally Michael. And that's where I was, when I was, like, I didn't know, I don't know if I didn't look at the credits, or there weren't credits, or they're just on the, you know, the inside of the record, but I'm listening to it, I remember whenever, I'm like, this totally sounds like Michael Schenker playing, like, what's going on here? And that's when I finally figured out that he's on the record. But yeah, and there was a big rift between him and his brother over that they had that, what is it, the 40th anniversary or whatever it was, of Love Drive came out, and they took all, they none of his credits are on there. And on Wikipedia, he's not credited on there. And he definitely had, I mean, I don't know what his input on, if the rest was just solos for the rest of those songs, but definitely Coast to Coast is him.
So I guess Matthias, you know, gets the gig for the tour, and then they're going to head into the 80s with Matthias, who I think is fucking awesome too. But that'll be for the next episode. So now we've each picked our top 10 favorite Scorpion songs from the 70s. And so you want to just, we'll count them down starting at 10 and take turns?
Sure.
To our number one?
Sure.
So do you want to go first, your 10th favorite?
I can go. My number 10 favorite 70s Scorpion song is Loving You Sunday Morning. And the first thing I got to say about this song is it is really a weird song to start a record off with. It seems like it should be like Love Drive or Another Piece of Meat should have been the first song, and this should have been the second song. But I think this is another one of those, you hear it and it's a Scorpion song. This is, you know, Herman, I believe, did the lyrics on this, so they're a little, they're not as risque as some of them. It's another one about, you know, trying to find a woman or something and worrying about losing her.
There's always that element of English as a second language in Herman's lyrics, too, that is amusing.
Yeah, and it's weird because it's different from English as a second language as the, you know, the hippie mystical stuff from before. I think Loving You Sunday Morning is a pretty, you know, I really like the song, but it's a fairly typical, you know, it has that kind of dreamy chorus part and then, you know, goes into your mid-tempo kind of Scorpions, like typical prototypical mid-tempo Scorpion song. I don't have a whole lot to say about it. I mean, the solo's nice, but again, it's buried, but it's a good solo. Of course, it's Schenker. I think the running thing with all of this stuff, even Scorpions through, even though I think Matthias is a little less unique than Michael or Uli, but there's always good guitar playing on the Scorpions records. Those guys can play. They're all good players, so.
Well, number 10 on my list is from In Trance. It's a pretty simple but heavy song called Top of the Bill. I think Klaus is great on it, and it's kind of early version of heavy metal with some great melodic guitar too. So
yeah, I think that's a real nice I went through this list about 20 times and it changed, so if you ask me, if we did this tomorrow, it might be different again. Because I was changing it this morning. But there's a nice riff, and the intro guitar solo is really nice to this song.
Yeah, it's maybe too simple, but I just I've always liked it. But yeah, I could have flipped out a few songs at number 10 there when I was thinking about, you know. It seems like number 10 is always the hardest with a list like this because there's different contenders, and then there's ones that you just have to leave out of the list completely. And yeah,
Yeah, 9 and 10 for me were like I could have swapped out.
Yeah, right.
But yeah, that's a that was one that was I had on. I think I had a list of 15 or 16, and that was initially on the list, but whatever day it was, I changed my mind. It went away. Yeah. So.
I like the guitar melodies on it probably the most of anything.
Number 9 on my list, and it kind of goes to what you say, it's kind of a simple song, but In Your Park, there's two specific reasons for In Your Park being on my list. Is it's kind of a song that's in half. Like, there's not a lot to it. There's two verses, and then there's like a chorus, and then kind of the, you know, coda kind of thing at the end. But in the second verse, they have these backing vocals that come in, these kind of soft kind of weird vocals that I think are great. I'm like, I really wish it would have been in the first verse also, but there's something about it that really sticks with me, and that is one of the reasons I put it on. And the thing that put it over the top to put it on this list for me is at the end, in the coda end part of the song, Uli kind of revisits those backing vocals but on guitar, and I just, the way that worked together and kind of brought that all back just made me put this on the list. And those two parts of the song, like the chorus is kind of nondescript, typical Scorpions ballad kind of chorus, but those two pieces and the guitar playing at the end, I just put it over the top for me.
Yeah, I like that song a lot. It could have definitely could have made my list. Definitely was on the short list. I look around and see the sunshine in the morning. Okay, number 9 on my list is from Taken by Force, The Riot of Your Time, which is just a cool, inventive song. It's quirky, but it works. And I think Klaus is great on this song.
This is my number eight song.
All right. Yeah.
Yeah. This one initially didn't get on my list. As I said, this list has been ever changing. But then I listened to it, and I'm like, I really, really love this song. And it's weird. The lyrics are about, well, the first part's about Elvis dying. And then it's this kind of weird fantasy about who's going to take over for Elvis and be that guy in like 1994, 95. That's the 94, 95 parts of the song. And again, this is the German as a second language, you know, a storm full of life, wild and young, the X-Rock 94 electric fire is one of the lyrics. But it's about who's going to be the new hero because Elvis, you know, the King of Rock is the King of Rock is gone and gone to heaven is the first lyric, and about who's going to replace him.
My number eight is concert staple Holiday, but they never do the cool heavy second half of the song, at least right. Not when I saw them. They just make it a big sing-along.
They do that Worldwide Live, they do that too, right? Is it the full song on Worldwide Live?
Probably not, because
I don't think it is, because I remember that bumming me out, I think.
Yeah, they would just always do, just make it a big sing-along, but they would never do... Yeah, I knew the song. I think I knew the song before I got Love Drive. And then when I heard the second part, I was like, holy shit, this is awesome, you know? The Longing for the Sun part. So,
yeah.
Yeah, but without that part, it's still good. But yeah, that really makes it a lot better. So if you only know it live, then you don't even know how cool it is. So.
Yeah, this is another one. This is one of the ones, I said I knew Michael wrote on Coast to Coast. But he says he wrote the intro guitar part to this song. Holiday didn't make my list, but I love this song. When I was listening to the songs, it's almost kind of like the song is unfinished. Even with that second part on there, it just kind of... I don't know if it goes anywhere. I love it, though. It just didn't make my list or whatever, you know.
Yeah, it's basically two different songs stuck together.
Right.
They were trying different things, and that, you know, in the 70s, they were trying a lot of different things, and it's fun to watch them develop and just try different shit, so.
Oh, yeah, for sure. My number seven is the song we discussed a bit earlier, the prototypical Scorpion song, Speedy's Coming. And I chose this because, I mean, I just like this song. This is one of the, you know, I don't know if there's anything that stands out song-wise besides that this is like, here's what the Scorpions are going to sound like in the future, you know, on Fly the Rainbow. I don't know, it's just kind of a good rocker. It moves along. The guitar parts, Yuli just plays to the song and excellent things that just, I think, make it, you know, when I say it's just kind of a regular song, but then you know, you add that thing, the Uli part to it, and it just is, it just takes it to another level. Again, we got lyrics about being, you know, a rock star, poster on the wall kind of thing, and, you know, they name check Alice Cooper, Ringo Starr, and David Bowie in it, and playing Royal Albert Hall, so it's another looking to become a rock star kind of lyric song. But yeah, I just think it's a good all. It's kind of, you know, the intro to the new Scorpions, and Uli plays the hell out of it.
Yeah, that's coming up on my list at number five. It's a very early heavy metal, basically. I mean, when you break it down, it's back at 74, and they've already, like you said, you can put it, I love it first thing, so that's pretty cool.
Yeah, and I think the thing in the production on this is pre-Dieter Dierks, but that I think helps make it. It's a dirty, heavy sounding song. I mean, it's powerful, and there's a lot of oomph to it. So, which is, you know, I'm sure people going like from Lonesome Crow, and then you get Speedy's Coming, going like, what the hell happened here? This is pretty intense.
So my number seven is another song from Taken by Force, kind of similar to The Riot of Your Time, called We'll Burn the Sky, which is another... Scorpions did a lot of the soft, loud, you know, dynamics, like songs with lots of dynamics, and the song is such a heavy metal song, too. It's got, like, so much of a... that kind of a feel, So it's just a really cool song, and, you know, different and creative as well. So
yeah, this is one that was in the initial list that I started making. I don't know if this actually made in the top 10, but this is another, this song for me easily could have been 8, 9, 10 on my list. I really enjoy it.
Yeah.
Number 6 on my list comes in with Love Drive. This is the first Scorpion song I heard. I love this song. I believe this is Love Drive? No, Love Drive is just Mina and Mine, whichever way you want to say it, and Rudolf Schenker. It's another one of these I'm really interested in this girl lyrics from Klaus, like, and I'd like to be with her, and you know, it's definitely a little more driving. I think it's a little more lusty than in love kind of a thing that he wants to be with her. But the guitar part, that kind of back and forth riff after, you know, in the chorus, where his love drive, da-da-da-da-da-da, I always love that, the intensity. And this is the song that got me into the Scorpions. I was like, hell yeah, I need more of this.
Yeah, I considered swapping that one with Top of the Bill, actually, at my number 10 when I was figuring out my list. I love the little play on words where he ends the chorus with love and then you drive me crazy. So
yeah,
you get that little...
Right.
My number 6 is another one of the soft, heavy, quiet, loud songs, In Trance, the title track. Great hooks on the chorus. So, I don't know.
Yeah, In Trance is, well, depending on what minute you're asking me, right now on my list, it depends if I'm looking at the one I made or I'm looking at the one that's on my phone, it's 2 or 3. I'll go with this list because I made this one second. So that's number 3 on my list. This song is amazing. Again, it's kind of your typical ballad to loud kind of song. The guitar playing, again, Uli is amazing on it. I think probably a little... This is In Trance, possibly more the prototypical start of this type of song for the Scorpions. I mean, I know there's a few moments on Fly to a Rainbow like that, but this seems kind of like, you know.
Just the hooks on the chorus are fucking great. It's
Yeah. Song. A lot of, and that's the one thing, and we were talking, what I like about, I like Klaus, you know, he may not have the greatest voice, but he's a good singer, but his melody lines are great.
Yeah,
and I think that's a good example of it, that the whole in I'm in a trance, you know, vocal part in the chorus is great. I think we are out up to number 5. This is going to be the last entry from Love Drive in my list. I thought you'd have more Love Drive, but maybe that's coming up more at the top. Another piece of meat. This is typical Herman Rarebell.
Yes.
Lyrics. They're just crude, uncouth,
yeah,
wrong. English is a second language, kind of weird. Herman's lyrics. Hey, let's go. Don't put on a show. You're just another piece of meat. I'm not quite sure there needs to be anything worse. I think that's like everything Herman Rarebell has to say about anything, apparently, in his lyrics. But, you know, I like the little staccato verse part and then into the real fast chorus part. And the guitar solo is great. I think this one's a little louder on this. But Shankar's guitar solo is fantastic. And it's just a good, you know, kind of back and forth. Scorpions seem to like that. Like, this is another one of those cases. It's not, you know, like, heavy and quiet, but it's more like this kind of staccato thing into this fast driving part.
Right, yeah, yeah.
And this is, you know, this might be another one that's in here this high or whatever because of, I think this was my favorite Scorpion song for a while when I was, you know, younger, so.
Yeah, I don't think that wasn't really a contender for my list. I liked that song, but it didn't really even make the short list.
Yeah, well, I think you were kind of talking on the other thing that this is another one of the heavier ones. You know, it's got the fast stuff always is compelling to me. We'll be right back.
my number five is Speedy's Coming, which we already talked about. So what's your number four?
My number four is Sales of Charon, or Charon, or however you say that.
I knew that was going to be on your list, yeah.
I think, first of all, it's kind of weird. Like, if you listen to that weird kind of funky riff he's got going there, I think this is the best example of a Yuli song, and Klaus singing it. If Klaus sang every Yuli song, they'd be so much better.
Yeah.
Because if singing this, it's not nearly as good. And I like the song as it is, but the guitar playing on this is possibly some of the best guitar playing ever. This is one of the mystical songs, you know, Dark Angel's Kingdom and stuff like that. I'm not even quite sure what they're talking about. Black magic, all that kind of stuff. But it's, you know, an epic number. And the guitar playing is unbelievable in it. Just some of the soloing, it's amazing.
Yeah, I think it's, for me, it's like, I like it in the context of the whole album, but it doesn't stand out for me as an individual song. But the whole record is cool. But it's like kind of a jam song, right?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah
it's definitely, and I think it's definitely a lot of based around, you know, I don't know if the chord progressions and then that solo came before anything, because the solo is really, you know, I don't think that song is nearly, there's like a solo right in the beginning that, you know, again, if it's not there, it's the part that takes the song to a whole nother level. And I'm amazed every time I hear it.
My number four, mine was down at, I think, number 10 on your list, Loving You Sunday Morning, which is just a fun rock song. It's pretty simple, but, like, I love the whoa, rap-pa-pa-pa-pa part, and then, like, the riff that comes in after that.
There's, you know, they always say there's a fine line between, you know, funny and stupid, or there's a fine line between making noises in a song. Like, there's many times it's like, wow, what the hell are you doing? But that part is great. Like, to me, it's genius. I'm like, how do you come up with this? Do you have nothing else to say? And that was that's the initial just track. I'm going to say something here, and it never got covered, but yeah, I love that part too.
It kind of makes the song, because it adds enough to it. It's something it needed. It needed something more, I guess.
Yeah, I think there's a lot. I mean, I think that's like the case of a lot of music. Is like, you know, and I definitely think I've been in situations and bands I've been with the same thing. It's like, you know, if we just would have taken a couple more days or hours or whatever it is, and just added something like that to the song that just would have taken it somewhere that it wasn't, it never got to. And I think Scorpions do that a lot, and I think Klaus's vocal lines, I think, do that a lot. I think Uli's guitar playing on the early stuff does that. I think for that, between as far as more pop direction songwriting, between Love Drive and Love at First Sting, they just figured out how to write songs really well. But
yeah,
they had that ability to make something that, you know, I think we get a lot of it. It's just, you know, like you say, this is just a fun rock song, but there's the elements that is what the Scorpions are that just takes it to that next level that some bands can't, you know, reach. I mean, I love German heavy metal, except like bands nobody's ever heard of that are just not real good, and that's part of it. But you know, I like the German part of it, but they don't have the personality that the Scorpions or Accept had in what they did to take it to that next level. Number three is Entrance. So we cover that, you know, the prototypical ballad for Scorpions. And so
yeah,
we hit that one.
My number three is Catch Your Train from Virgin Killer. Fucking love this killer song. Love the guitar sound, the mix and the production, like I was saying about Virgin Killer, sounds so great. What I wrote down, I wish they would have called the song Whiskey Cola, because that would have been awesome. Song title, fucking great song. So
yeah, this is another one I toyed with on the list, and I think I did a thing that I wanted to represent every record with two songs, and it just didn't happen with Fly the Rainbow, so I think that's why this got cut. But I love the riff, is great, that kind of driving noodly kind of riff, and then the guitar solo that he does that comes over that is great.
It's a great, like, fast paced like rock metal song with great great hooks. So
all right, I swapped these out. I'm going to go with my last list. This was number one at the inception of the list and changed yesterday. But Robot Man is my number two. The tremolo thing, the crazy vibrato guitar part, Klaus's vocal lines, the way he does it in the first half of the verse to the second half of the verse. Also, Yuli is just a small solo part. But as I said, I'm going to say this about every song, the solo just adds so much. His little just kind of melody line he pulls off for a couple measures, and it just is great. And the tremolo, I think this is one of the songs that every once in a while they kind of experiment with reggae or, you know, whatever they're doing. And, you know, that it's an anomaly, especially with that tremolo effect going on. But I love this song.
That's surprising because I never really liked that song. But I'll give it another listen.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things, though. It's like, I could understand why someone doesn't like it, because it's different, you know, and it's kind of a weird hippie take on an Iron Man, lyric-wise.
Yeah.
That is Iron Man. But yeah, I could see why you wouldn't like it. But like I said, there's that little two-measure guitar solo that is this melody line, and I love it.
My number two is a very poppy song from Entrance with great hooks, and it's really short too. It's called Longing for Fire. You know, it's just got a great melody, which is, I guess, what I like about it. There's nothing metal about it.
No. Well, and I think that's one of the nice things about what you had in the 70s is there was a lot less of worrying about if something was metal. And they talk about that in that book a lot about, you know, that they like to do a lot of, you know, why they thought their longevity is because they did soft and hard songs. The night wind brings me higher. It's a job light. Escape the night one day. She's lost in time. To space or high. We'll be right back.
Well, we've made it to our number ones. Our favorite Scorpion song of the 70s.
My favorite song of the 1970s Scorpions catalog is Pictured Life. Again, you go into this whole thing, it's kind of prototypical Scorpions, but the melody lines, the guitar playing, everything about it screams Scorpions. And I don't have a lot of things beyond this. Like, the guitar playing is really good. And I think it's got a good pace to it, and it moves real well. And I every time it comes on, and I turn it up louder.
Well, my number one is Pictured Life, so there you go. It's fucking great. What a great arrangement. Everything.
Yeah.
Great songwriting, great production, great melodies, great guitars. It's just fucking great, yeah.
Yeah.
It's the first song on Virgin Killer, so.
Yeah. I'm kind of surprised. I'm like, yeah, I wonder what his number one is, and it's the same.
Yeah, that song is really great. Well, so I was thinking with this for this episode about Scorpions in the 70s, we could, for the To Play Us Out song, I'll say, and now To Play Us Out.
What does that mean, To Play Us Out? I don't know what that means, To Play Us Out. What does that mean? To end the show?
Yeah.
You know, in 79, also Uli's first album I guess he was just credited as a band at that point, Electric Sun.
Yeah.
His first post-Scorpions release came out, Earthquake. He was totally doing his Hendrix thing. Like, he's so similar to Frank Marino. Like, they're both just want to be Hendrix. And which it's is, so obvious.
It's interesting. I like when he, because he's got a weird... The weird thing with him is that there's a classical influence, and there's a later records, like more recent ones, where he does all this classical stuff, which I like. But yeah, the Hendrix stuff is like... I don't know how noticeable it is on the Scorpion stuff, because it's kind of got this weird German thing, but on that stuff, it's like, holy Hendrix, dude.
Yeah. So this first post-Scorpions release by Uli John Roth, his band Electric Sun.
We'll be right back. be back.